Hi, I'm Dr. Rosalind Beer, and you're listening to Further with Founders. Throughout the series, I'll be speaking to business founders within the Further Network. They'll be telling me about their journey so far, the highs and the lows, the bootstrapping and the funding rounds, the business challenges and the human stories. The guest on this episode is Owen Cambay of Swan. Innovative fashion and e-commerce solution and the need for grit to survive. Enjoy the chat. Hi everyone, so joining me today is Owen Cambay, of CEO and founder of Swan, and also Niamh Stirling, partner in Further BC. So to start us off, Owen, can you talk to us about your background before you got started with Swan and in terms of your entrepreneurial journey to date?
Yeah, for sure. I started out and I did business economics in Trinity. And then within Trinity, there was a program called Launchbox. And then I used that to kind of leap into entrepreneurship itself. And I did it with Swan, and then I came back to it after college.
Okay, and before that, you had mentioned to me you were a little bit circuitous in your journey. So in terms of your college, you didn't exactly start off doing economics, did you?
No, I started in engineering, and then I swapped out at the end of my first year.
Okay, and what was the reason behind that?
I think initially I wanted to do engineering really with the idea that I would probably go in to start a company. I'd kind of read that a huge amount of CEOs of large companies had actually studied engineering first. So I thought I'd do engineering and then end up doing an MBA and then moving into business from there on. But I didn't quite enjoy engineering as much as I thought I would. So I swapped into business and economics and went from there.
Okay, and that was more suited. And then in terms of your entrepreneurial flair, so when did that start? Like, did you have any ventures when you were younger, before college? Did you have any ideas or concepts, or were you influenced by any entrepreneurs in your family or role models?
Yeah, surprisingly, I didn't do anything pre-college, but both my grandfathers were entrepreneurs. So they both ran their own companies, one in Ireland, one in France, and that's really kind of where it came from. I remember I had a dinner with my grandfather, and he told me I couldn't really figure out why he'd gone into the business he was doing. They did facilities management. It was a very large company in France and in Switzerland. Couldn't figure out why he'd gone into it. It's like terribly boring business. You know, they do security and all kind of tertiary activities that a company doesn't want to do at its core. And he just explained to me that there was a gap in the market in that time. And that's how I was introduced to the whole idea.
Okay, so you'd sort of seen that success and it was probably inspirational to you. So while you were in college then, talk to me about the program that you got involved in, and was that where Swan, the idea for Swan came about, or were you doing something else on the entrepreneurial program?
Yeah, it started out in Launchbox, but really the idea was exactly the same as it is currently. So at the time I did a huge amount of photography, mostly portraiture and self-portraiture as a kind of creative thing outside of college. And I was also naturally buying a lot of clothes. And I realized that there surely should be one way to do both together. And then Launchbox came around. We did Launchbox at the time. It was called Size, S-Y-Z-E. And it was very much the idea that we should be able to just put our phone down and get measured off the back of it. At the time, I didn't realize how difficult it would be, technically, to get really accurate measurements from a phone.
So were you coming at it from a consumer point of view that when you went in, or could you see the problem with other people around you in terms of friends and family trying to buy fashion? And was it online? Was that the main issue?
Yeah, it was always meant to be online. I think the consumer problem and the kind of business problem are very interrelated because you feel it. Like the issue is that you can't get the right size and then you end up either ordering two sizes, say bracketing, and then you have to deal with the return yourself. So you're clearly aware that it's inefficient.
Okay. So talk to me about Swan. Where did the name come from and why did you choose it?
Right. For Swan, I read this book called Positioning. And in the book, it was really interesting. They were talking about how you name companies. And there's one school of thought that says you come up with a new word, say like the Xeroxes, the Googles, and then you educate people about what that word actually means. And then there's a second group that go and they choose a symbol or a name that has positive connotations. So Apple, BlackBerry, Dove, Shell, you know, they all exist in this positive space in people's heads. And then you take that and you put your company on top of it. And for Swan, I felt like it was a symbol of simplicity, of elegance, of beauty, something that represented Ireland.
Okay. And that, oh yes, you're the Children of Lear. So
children
that was,
of Lear. Yeah, the nice. Company's called Lear Labs.
When I thought of Swan, I thought of the ugly duckling turning into a swan. And I also thought of that program where they turn people into with plastic surgery and complete makeovers. So to be honest, when I was first looking at it, a lot of these things came across my head. But they're all to do with kind of beauty, and I guess it is that same sort of sense. So the problem, you know, you said about building, and what was the technology that, you know, you were actually going to create? So to resolve the sizing issue, what did you want to do?
Make it incredibly easy and accurate for people to get their measurements, because inherently people don't know them, or they like to think they know them, but they don't. So like current competitors, they would have things like surveys where you answer a bunch of questions, but it can never work because the information you're putting into the system is erroneous. So the information that comes back also is. So we thought that if we could take it from a video or a photo, something that's super simple, something that everybody has in their phone, yeah, or pocket, and we could work from there.
Okay, so you're taking traditional sizing that if someone goes online, for example, and you're basically wanting to purchase an item of clothing. So how does Swan help the consumer, and what's the process around that?
So the way it happens is, say you're on a product page and you've chosen an item that you already want, and then you get prompted to go through a scan. And so it works on any phone, any browser, any environment. The only thing we ask is that you wear form-fitting clothing. And so you place your phone down, you stand back, you get guided through this process where we tell you, for example, if your feet aren't fully in frame or if your arm is out of frame, we tell you to pull them back in. You turn around once, we create a 3D model of your body and we measure that. And then we map those measurements to garment measurements that are used during the manufacturing process for the brand. And then off the back of that, we give you a sizing recommendation on a product page, but we also give you a thing called Fit View. And that's the idea that we're trying to increase the confidence of the buyer. So we show you a proportional model with fit notes, and we explain exactly why this will fit you.
Okay, amazing. And so you can basically use, are you selling to B2B, like retailers, in terms of their online, you know, customers? Is that what the plan is in terms of your market strategy, route to market?
Yeah, exactly. So for brands, it's really inefficient. So they've got really low conversion rates and really high return rates. Conversion rates 2-3%, return rates industry average like 30, and go well above 50. Germany has like 40-50% average return rates. Plus size goes even higher still because the sizing gets even more difficult. But really what we're trying to do is bridge that current gap that brands have of struggling to sell online in a way that's efficient. And where we want to go to is a world where it's much more personalized, it's much more about you. You know, it's no more like random models and bits of text. I really think that current e-commerce feels like a magazine. Like it was directly adopted from a fashion magazine. And though really we should build a much more native version that is around you and your body.
Okay. So talk to me about the journey. You have a bit of an interest in engineering and obviously fashion and photography. So setting up Swan, you know, what skill set were you lacking, and who did you need to get on the team? You know, so, and talk to us about that journey.
Yeah, probably most of them. I'd never really had a proper job.
Okay, so. You were the ultimate.
I was very much straight out of college. So I probably didn't know most. I spent a huge amount of time on Twitter reading different blogs or trying to figure out what was going on. And off the back of that, we went in and we did a comp fund. So a commercialization fund off Enterprise Ireland. And that allowed us to spin into the research center at ADAPT in Trinity. And from then, they were super, super useful. So they helped us with kind of much more technical areas like the computer vision. We got a PI who helped us build out an initial research team, spent the first year just proving that it was possible, because a huge amount of people said it wasn't, you know, that you would be able to get measurements from a phone. Seemed a bit bizarre, or at least that it could be accurate. I think probably because it was a bit of scar tissue, people had tried to do this before, but it never worked. So we spent the first year in research just proving that it was possible. At the end of the year, we had a model that it took 15 minutes and it was accurate to 10 centimeters. So it was dreadful, but it existed. And then over the following year, we really refined that down. We changed the team, focused much more on optimization. We'd retrain our models every 1 to 2 months. And now we're at a point where it's super accurate and super fast.
Okay, so talk to me about that, because I remember in a previous conversation, you talked about the IT development and the kind of some of the issues. So it would be great to share that, you know, some of the pitfalls or things that you learned along the way in terms of, getting the team together and maybe, you know, mistakes that were made that cost you a bit of time and a bit of, you know, difficulty. So can you talk to us about that? It's a really interesting part of the story.
Yeah, for sure. I think initially I probably trusted people too quickly. I had this kind of bias where I would just go, oh, well, this person's great and they're going to figure this out. And really some of the times they didn't have the grit, or I completely misunderstood their own experience and that they wouldn't be ready for it. Or simply coming out of research into trying to create a product, there's quite a gap there between people who are excellent research but who don't really care about customers or users or the end use case. So it was like an interesting technical problem to them. And then when it came to actually spinning it out into a product, they weren't interested. So made quite a few kind of hires that didn't work out, learned off the back of those. You know, I think grit, super, super important. So there were plenty of questions I used to ask. By default, all the computer vision guys were always really good because they did PhDs. So, you know, you have to have grit. It's desperately lonely and long journey. And you come out.
I know.
So you come out the end and, you know, you're pretty good at that point. But for the other roles, it was harder. Part of that was because I didn't quite understand what was missing. So we had points where we had guys that we brought on to lead, you know, in effectively a tech lead role to do development and engineering, that type of stuff. And who bounced out just before we were due to launch. And that obviously created issues because all our timelines went, we had to go back and rebuild everything. So that was just a period where we just, you know, had to keep going with a lot less funding. And EI were super supportive. And at the end of that, we came out, spun out of Trinity and raised a seed.
Do you think looking back, would you have been better kind of trying to source a co-founder, a tech, or doing, you know, would you change it in any way? Or do you think it was just part of the journey?
No, I don't know. I don't think you can change anything. It happens the way it happens. And yeah.
I think, you know, on that point, because there's a lot of challenges there, but I think going to that resilience part, you know, the fact that, can you talk to us about that? You know, the grit that you mentioned, having to keep going when things are not working, when things are failing, when people are letting you down. So, you know, how did that feel? I mean, you said it was quite lonely. So what kept you going?
I think maybe because I was a sole founder, that it became part of me. Right, at that point when it's so intrinsically part of you, you can't really detach yourself from it and you have to make it work. It's not really a choice anymore. And I think everybody who's done it has probably gone through something very similar. So it's probably nothing new. And at the end of the day, you can just give up or you can keep going.
But were you passionate, I guess, about your idea? Like at that point you wanted to prove and you knew it could work. Was that kind of that self-belief that you had?
Yeah, I mean, we kept on coming across a problem. Like, everybody's always buying clothes. Everybody's always talking about how difficult it is to buy clothes. It's apparent that there needs to be a solution. You know, we just had to keep going to make sure it was us.
Okay, great. Well, it sounds like it is a difficult journey, you know, but it sounds like you kind of kept at it. So talk to us about the funding. So you mentioned you obviously had help with Enterprise Ireland, obviously coming out of Trinity. So how has it been funded to date? And then, you know, where are you at in that sort of journey?
Yeah, so we were funded through a commercialization fund through Enterprise Ireland. So when we, after Launchbox or during Launchbox, was approached by somebody in the research center who said this actually, you know, is quite similar to stuff that we do or we have expertise in, and there's this program that allows you to go out and get money for research with the aim of spinning it back out into a company thereafter. So we did that and we had incredible support, really good kind of people in EI through the whole period. And raised, I think it was like roughly 300,000 as a grant. And then we used that to fund the entire research and spun out of Trinity last summer.
Okay, amazing. So, Niamh, just talking about funding and investment, you know, can you just talk to us about what investors and VCs are looking for when they're trying to invest in a company and what are the key, you know, pillars that they really look to find?
Yeah, sure. Well, congratulations on your progress to date, Owen. And I'm laughing because my background is facilities management and and I lectured, or didn't lecture, I mentored for Launchbox and I was a founder previously as well. So I'm listening to your story with great enthusiasm, but I'm on the other side of the table, I guess, now. You know, look, when Owen talks about grit, you know, people still invest in people and from a venture capital perspective, finding a really great team is really important. That's really where it starts. It's not where it ends, but it's where it starts. So when you meet founders who are tenacious and have that level of, and talking about grit, actually, I was going to say, you know, I think an awful lot of people talk about motivation and sometimes it's about discipline, because actually you don't always, you know, you need to get up every day and do it even if you don't have the motivation to do it. I think that's a, you know, a common trait that you'd see within entrepreneurs. But, you know, finding founders who are incredibly passionate about the product that they're building. One of the big key pieces is, are you actually solving a real world problem? You know, and for sure, like, you can see the numbers in terms of like the likes of the returns and the problems that the retailers are having with that, and it's so costly for them. So they know that there's a really big pain point there, you know. From a venture capital perspective, is that market big enough? And I don't specifically mean Swan, but you know, that's one of the things we're certainly going to be looking at. You might have a really, you know, clear pain point for companies, but actually, are there enough of them? Are there enough of them globally that's going to make this an investable venture? So, you know, and then along with that, then you're, as I said, you're looking at the team, you're looking at the problem. What's the solution? They're probably solving the solution some way. You know, how much better is your solution? Is this something that's nice to have as opposed to, you know, a necessary to have? And when we're meeting you, then, you know, we're looking at, you know, your strategy. You know, it depends on the stage and the age and stage of the company. So prior to venture capital, I worked in angel investment for 5.5 years. So where we had, you know, a broader spectrum of the types of companies and sectors that we would invest in. So, you know, we were looking for different things across those different sectors. So a medtech company is not going to be, you know, at the same level of traction as a B2B SaaS company is. So we were looking for entirely different metrics. You know, but for an early stage company that's in a B2B, that has that B2B play and a user adoption piece as well, a consumer adoption, you know, we're looking to see what kind of traction, what kind of conversations that you're having with customers, you know, and have you done a deal with them? And are they beginning to roll this product out because they're finding it so helpful that, and actually you can begin to see what the metrics look like in terms of what are you saving them in terms of time and money and, you know, resource that might be currently channeled into, you know, returns, or loss of sales because people are not being able to purchase what they want, or they're looking online but then they're going into the store to buy it, and you know, all of that goes with that consumer journey. So you know, adoption, you know, and looking at your early adopters in the marketplace. Again, depending on the age and stage, are you selling currently into one market? Are you beginning to expand into other markets, other retailers? So you haven't got one customer. So we're looking at de-risking that by looking at, you know, a number of different retailers in might be different verticals, depending, again, not just if it was in say clothing retail. And then just making sure that you've got a really robust business plan as well. You know, and that you're showing that you're able to execute on that is really important. Having a good grasp of your financials, I would have said, from the angel perspective, and that's when I was looking at meeting founders, I would have said the route to market out of 90% of the companies that I'd meet, route to market was probably the thinnest on the ground. And they're early stage companies, so you're not going to know it all. But I do want to understand that, you know, you've gone and you've done, you know, your research on this, and that you're actually able to validate your assumptions. Why are you assuming that your route to market is direct and not through a distributor? Why are you assuming that, you know, channel partnership is going to work or doesn't, or whatever it might be? But I want to be able to see that actually you've gone and validated this. This is because the competitors are doing it this way. This is the way the market is turning. These are, you know, so talk to me about those, how you de-risk this as an investment opportunity. And then also having a good grasp of your financials. You'd be surprised the number of decks that come in and the P&L and the figures don't balance. So understanding, and it's not that he expects you to be, you know, have a completely conversive in it, which if you're a CEO and a founder of a company, you need to have a reasonably good grasp of your numbers, you know.
Especially if you're going to be actually asking for money.
Yeah, and you're looking at investor-ready companies, I'm not talking about. And you were saying there earlier, Owen, you know, the stuff that you don't know. Knowing what you don't know is just as important as understanding what you do, right? You know that as well. Go and ask for help. It is perfectly okay to say, we've a gap in our team here. I want to see that actually you recognize that you need, you know, a head of platform, or that your next hire is going to be, you know, a marketing, you know, CMO or whatever it might be, whatever it is for your particular company. I'd much rather see you say to me, you know, I know we've a big gap there, and actually we're raising to fill that gap. And here's the difference that it's going to make for the company. This is what we're going to do with that. Yeah. These are the milestones that we're going to achieve on this capital that you're going to invest in my company.
Okay, thanks. So on that, so the milestones, where are you in the kind of phasing of growth and kind of the development now at this point?
So we've built out the core tech and it works. And I think hopefully this kind of points to one of the things you said is I think we've de-risked the tech. So I think a lot of people have tried to do what we've tried to do before or what we're trying to do. Like, it's a very big problem that people are clearly aware of. And I think there were two major risks. One was tech, like, can it be done? So I think we've hopefully proven that. And the other one was market risk, is that I don't think there was enough penetration in e-commerce before to actually make this work, and there weren't the platforms to support it. So currently we're based off Shopify because that allows us easy integration, but also there's a huge amount more purchases happening online. So I think both of those are in a good place. As to where we are now, we have a product that works really well, that's really solid, and we're going out and we're launching with kind of small to medium sized brands. So the brands typically they're doing, they've passed the threshold of 5,000 orders a month. For us, that means that they're professional, that they have, and by professional I mean that they've proper teams in place, their product sells well, they've got proper marketing, it's a top three priority for them because they've grown to the point that, you know, at an industry average return rate of say 30%, 5,000 orders a month, 1,500 coming back roughly, it's incredibly inefficient, and that's of the sales that convert. So they're at a point where they can now invest heavily in, say, proper warehousing or these other things, or they can just solve the problem at its root cause and end up with higher sales. Because for us, we reckon that an extra sale is worth 10 times what a reduction in return is. But it's no point having those sales if you don't have efficient returns.
Can I ask you, just in terms of the ecosystem, have you found starting up in Ireland, you know, being beneficial for you in terms of your journey? In supports and things that you've availed of and expertise and raising investment, etc. Has it been useful?
Very. Although, like, I can't know what the counterfactual is. But we've had incredible support from EI, particularly. I mean, starting out at the time that I was trying to do this, I was, like, in the middle of college. I hadn't had a job. I really had no expertise at all. But through the confunding, through the support in Trinity with, you know, people in the Adapt Centre and in Trinity Research and with EI, they were able to kind of help me along that journey.
And do you feel like you have a really good team now? I mean, have you collected around you people who are passionate and dedicated and have that grit? Is that, you know, at the stage you're at, is that something that's important?
Yeah, 100%. I've kind of hired for the things I don't really know or understand, or currently anyway. So we've got a really strong kind of commercial side of it that comes from a prior virtual fitting room startup that was called Fits.me. And so they tried to do this around 2014. They were reasonably successful. And then they were bought by Rakuten. But the problem is the way they did it, it was all based on robotics. So you'd fly clothes over to Estonia where they had these robots. The robots would then distort the clothing or kind of push it out so as it looked like it was a person, photograph it, and then put it online. Obviously, all of that costs a huge amount of money. You've got to fly the clothes over. You've got to run the robots. Then the clothes are out of circulation. It has to be done within a certain time for the clothes to get sold. But with us, we don't have any of that. So we're much more efficient. We just, you know, use your phone anywhere, anytime. So our commercial team comes from there. The research side, we have a really strong research element. Guys who worked in some of the top AI labs around the world. And then who are now with us and in Trinity, and then kind of development side, we've got two guys who were co-founders together in a prior startup.
Okay, amazing. Very exciting. So just kind of my last two questions, what advice would you give to others listening, you know, who are starting out or maybe scaling, you know, what would you suggest that they think about or look at that are the key pillars of success that you found?
Grit, obviously a really big one. I think questioning yourself and being very skeptical of advice that people give you. Because everybody has a piece of advice, and most of the time they go against other advice that you've already gotten, and it's probably some form of projection off them or coming from a point that they're trying to inform you of a really position that they have, but that might not be true because they might not be a fit. I think asking certain questions, you know, when hiring, I ask questions like, I ask if somebody's been obsessive about something in the past, because I really think you have to be in a startup. Do they believe they're lucky? Because that tells me that they have agency and they're optimistic about the future. These are the kind of questions like what you believe that others don't and things like that that I really like asking. So I think asking a lot of questions and doing a lot of references and asking other people what they think about. So mostly on hiring.
So what's next? So for in terms of your vision, let's see, because I know you've a lot of ideas and a lot of this can go in so many different directions. So do you want to share with us what you really would love to see happen with Swan? I think that's the most interesting part.
For sure. So where we're currently at is we're solving sizing because it's an immediate business problem that brands face. It's the returns, it's the low conversions. But really where we want to get to is, you know, like Cher's closet from Clueless, where you interact with it. And
I
it's
haven't seen the movie. Have you seen it yet? No.
I have.
Oh, you
I've
did?
Seen it a bunch of times.
Okay, super. So, yeah. So Cher has her wardrobe in the Clueless movie, Alicia Silverstone. And she has the, I remember 20 years ago, and the she's putting on the clothes. And it's her physical avatar. So is that kind of the future? Is that really what you're envisioning?
A virtual avatar, yeah. Away from this kind of e-commerce as a magazine that it currently is, into one where you start on a version of yourself that's kind of anatomically correct or reasonably so, and you swap in clothes and it's much more like a game, because I think the way people shop is based around outfits, not around individual items. So when we currently look at something, we look at a model that looks nothing like us, with limited information, or even it's like pinched at the back and then the photo is taken and then it's all text based and it's just quite difficult. It arrives, it's nothing like what you want. But what I want it to be is it's a virtual version of yourself, and you swap in clothes and you build outfits around it. And you can share your measurements with friends or family. So coming up to Christmas or whatever, they can buy you that thing that you really want. And it exists in fashion, and then past that hopefully as well.
Okay, super. And what's the expectation, you know, the next 3 to 5 years, you know, go move beyond Ireland, UK, US? I mean, is that the plan is big?
Hopefully. I mean, that's what the plan is. Currently, we're only selling into the UK. And Ireland. And the UK has the highest kind of e-commerce penetration in the world. It's like the most developed market. Most of the brands are mostly high street brands, so simple enough clothing for us to deal with. It's next to impossible to sell into France. So we start with the UK, and then we'll go to America and Canada and go from there up to bigger and bigger brands.
Okay, super. Listen, thanks for sharing your story. It's been really inspiring. Thank you, Owen, and thanks, Niamh. You've been listening to the Further with Founders podcast. I am Dr. Rosalind Beer. I'm looking forward to you joining us on our next episode.